Welcome, everyone, to Digital Media E10, Exposing Digital Photography. Today, we're going to talk about even more software tools. And today, I decided to wear a tie, really to distract you from what inevitably ends up being kind of a train wreck. Not because that I don't hopefully know what I'm talking about, but because everything today is like a live demo and stuff always goes wrong. So hopefully, we've already gotten it out of the way with sort of our late start, but we'll see as time goes on whether I forget where buttons are or things happen. So hopefully you'll be able to bear with me as we work through all of these things. Now, today we're basically going to be talking about a variety of topics related to software tools, not just related to Photoshop and to software that's related to that, but also to other software as well. And a loose collection of those topics that we're going to be talking about is here on the board. But this is meant to be very fluid. We'll be talking about a lot of these things up until we kind of run out of time. But if you have some other topic that you think would be very interesting that we should add to this, we can indeed add it. And we will try to address any topics that you have as well as we possibly can. So basically today we'll talk a little bit about smartphones. So just because we're talking about software tools doesn't mean that we're going to be talking exclusively about those software that we could use on our laptops. But also we'll move on to things like geocoding, dealing with contrast, saturation, vibrance, what these actually mean, dealing with a little bit of levels, tone curves, the layers, specifically as we get into Photoshop, and some things that are really useful, like adjustment layers and compositing and masking and some of these other things. Now, many of these things, or some of these things, you may already be familiar with in some way, but hopefully today we'll get a chance to talk about them in just a little bit more depth before we start talking about a lot of these things in even more detail in the following weeks. So to start out with, I did, as usual, just want to do a couple of reminders. One of them is that problem set 3 is due today. What did I just do with? Oh, here it is. Problem set 3 is due today. As you know, on the submission tool, problem set 4 was just released, and that's due 2 weeks from now. And project 3 is due next Wednesday, or rather this coming Wednesday. And that, of course, is a group project. If you haven't yet taken a look at the project itself, I highly recommend that you do so, because you'll need to sort of find a group in order to accomplish the project. And you can do that by asking around on the blog, or by, if you are having difficulty, send an email to us and we'll be able to pair you up with others that are also looking for a group. Also, if you happen to be participating in the live discussion online in any of the sections in person or online, or even here today, then feel free to look around and talk to some other people and see if you'll be able to join their group towards accomplishing Project 3. And just as a reminder, when you do email us, please do email the staff list, staff@dme10.org. For some reason this week, there was a bit of an uptick in emails that went directly to me, and I also happened to be out of town this weekend, so it was very difficult for me to respond to a lot of these on time. So by sending an email to staff@dme10.org, it sends it to all of us, and we'll be able to, by all of us, I mean all of the staff, we'll be able to respond the most quickly when you send an email to the staff list. If there's any questions about any of that, please do, of course, send us an email or let us know. All right, so let's talk a little bit about software tools. Now, some of the things that are really interesting about software tools, especially in the past couple of years, is now the explosion of these devices that are handheld, that allow us to do modifications to photographs and also take photographs in relatively high quality. When I first started this class back in 2007, it really would have been sort of unheard of, or I might have been laughed off camera or laughed off the podium by saying that it was legitimate to use a camera that you would find on one of those old school flip phones. But nowadays, it really is the case that the quality of these has gotten to such a degree that we can use it in a wide variety of circumstances, not only just casually, but there are many instances of professional photographers as well using these devices, maybe not for all of their work, but for some subset of their work. And because they happen to use the right tool for the job, these smartphones certainly fall into this category. And there's a few things to note about all of this software that exists for smartphones. It used to be the case, particularly for iPhones, that we didn't have an enormous amount of control over the exposure values for the iPhones. But now, with the most recent iOS update, which, by the way, there's sort of like this slow adoption rate for it for some reason or another, and in fact, My own phone isn't even upgraded to it, but the one feature I kind of lust after with this newest update is related to the camera, which does allow full manual control over the exposure values for that camera. And there's a couple of apps that have come out that address this. One of them is called Manual for iOS, and it's going to be, I realize now, very difficult for me to find on the internet. Let's see, Manual iOS, just at the moment here. So this happens to be it. Now this is just one example, and in fact, one of the things that you'll notice particularly today is that we will be talking about specific software, but just realize that this is software that I have either used, in this case I haven't used this, but I've either used or heard of or can talk a little bit about, but that doesn't necessarily mean that is the only option for you. Particularly with Photoshop, although that is sort of the industry standard for doing large manipulations to images, that is not the only image manipulation software that exists out there. And so long as you pick something that is the good tool for your use, then you're more than welcome to use that. So again, just because we're using some software here, or we're using it as an example, or we're showing some features of it, doesn't mean that you have to use that strictly in your own work for this class, or even especially outside of this class as well. But with that said, this app, Manual, allows full control over the exposure in a phone that is running this latest version of the OS. And Android phones, I think, to varying levels have had some control over their exposure for a little bit longer than iPhones. But even with a lot of these apps, some of the things that we find are some interesting features, such as the ability to separate selecting points. So you might be familiar on a smartphone when you are holding the phone and you're pointing it at a particular scene, you can tap on some portion of that scene and it will focus on that portion of the scene, which is great, but it will also lock the exposure based on that portion of the scene. And as we had talked about earlier on in this class, that's not always necessarily what we want. Sometimes we want to separate the exposure from the focus so that we could, for example, focus on something that might be a little bit darker or a little bit brighter than a middle gray, and we can set the exposure to some other value as well. There's another iPhone app that has, actually, again, because I happen to have an iPhone, a lot of these examples will be iPhone-centric, but for those of you that use Android phones, please do feel free, especially on Twitter, sort of recommend to us some that you see or some that you use, and we can retweet those for those of you that happen to use Android devices as well. But one of the nice camera apps for iPhone that does allow you to sort of separate this is this app called Camera Plus. Which does have this sort of feature, and it supplies a number of other camera-like features to your iPhone that allow you to take a lot of really powerful photos with the device that you have in your pocket. And one of the things that you'll see online particularly are the best photos that you take are with the camera that you have with you. And in many cases, it's not possible for us to carry our larger cameras with us, and as a result, using these devices and learning to use them is certainly well within our rights as photographers. It's something that we should certainly do, and to understand their limitations and be able to use them. But they do actually offer some advantages as well. In particular, just beyond this idea of having that camera with you all the time, these devices have a lot of sensors built into them. And a lot of these sensors are actually used to inform the metadata that is put into the photograph. And we talked a little bit about this when we were talking about EXIF data, and in the last software tools lecture, we were talking about how phones, I gave sort of a word of warning, and it was a bit more cautionary, perhaps, than I wanted it to be cautionary, but I didn't want it to put you off from the idea, was that it does embed location information within your photos. And this can be really great when you take some photographs. Perhaps you actually want to go back and know precisely where you were when you took those photos. Or maybe you can be extra geeky and you can have a website that actually shows a map with all of the locations of the photos that you've actually taken. Now, that may not be super relevant if you're taking a lot of studio shots or in-home shots, but it certainly is relevant if you like to do a lot of candid photography, a lot of travel photography. If you like to be out and about when you're doing your photographs, as I do, then that's certainly useful information. maybe it's kind of neat to have a lot of dots on a map, but it's also, I found it very useful for me to remember, for me to have that data so that I can find photos more easily, because I might remember a photo based on its location rather than being able to search for it by metadata or being able to search for it maybe even by date if it was a particularly long time ago. So one of the advantages that smartphones have for us then is precisely this, that because they have this location information already available to them, they can embed it within the photo itself. And some of you might have noticed this discrepancy. What happened with me certainly was that when I had an SLR and now when I'm using my mirrorless system, sometimes I think twice about whether or not I actually want to use that camera because I know I'm not going to have that location information embedded within the image. Or that it's going to be a bit of a hassle for me to later on try to associate that image with a particular location. A lot of software like Lightroom, for instance, does have the capability to place photos on a map. So you can have a lot of photos and you can find precisely the location that you want and you can click and drag each one to the specific location, but this becomes as heinous as applying a lot of tags to each of your individual photos. Very early on when I first started to try to learn the organization techniques that I wanted to use for photos, I thought keywords were going to be the way to go, so I ended up over tagging everything. If it had a tree, I put the word tree. If it had an apple, I put the word apple, even if it wasn't relevant to the image. And this, of course, ended up being like just way too much. It just was way too much organization. It ended up being way too much information. The library, the database itself grew to an extent that it was very slow to search for images with particular tags. There were a lot of issues, and it would certainly feel the same way here if you were to do that. But there are apps that sort of bring us to the rescue here, and I did want to show one of them because although there's a wide variety of ways to actually achieve this, you probably have a smartphone, or you probably have some sort of phone that has this capability, and if not, you might soon in your next phone. You might actually have this capability in your next phone. So again, there are many apps that allow you to do this, but in this one, this is called Gaia GPS, G-A-I-A GPS. And this is, we're getting that echo again because of the microwave. Hopefully that's not too harsh on the online feed. Okay, so basically what this app is it's not really intended for photographers per se. This is really meant to be a GPS tracking app, and by that I mean it's really meant for hikers or when you're out in the wilderness and you need to have the USGS maps that actually show you all of the elevation data about your hike and that sort of thing. And this is actually a wonderful app for that, so I highly recommend it for that, especially if you do any sort of hikes and you need to have that map information. Just by downloading this app, you have all of that in very high resolution. You do have to download them offline, but since they're freely available, it still makes for a wonderful experience rather than having to go find these maps or purchase them elsewhere and actually maintain them with a compass. Then as you're actually proceeding along taking photos, one of the things that you can do is to actually create additional tracks. So every time you create a track, basically what it's doing is it's recording your GPS coordinates every second or every half second or so, and it's recording all of that information into a track, and it shows you a lot of information about that particular track in the trip computer, for example, which is kind of neat and kind of fun to see, perhaps. I think this was a hike recently, but I have noticed that one of the things about this is that it usually gets my maximum speed wildly off. I guarantee I was not moving 35 miles an hour on a hike. And also, I actually used this while mapping sort of a cross-country trip. I just wanted to know the location, and I just wanted to go back to find the route that I had taken much more easily than tracking it on a map manually. And it said my maximum speed was something like 160 miles an hour or something, and I had not even gone anywhere near that particular speed. But regardless of that, all of this is really fascinating because you can have all of this information, but even more importantly, this app actually syncs all of this data back to a website. And what's great about this is that you can then load up this information on the website, the Gaia GPS website, and you have a list of all of the tracks that you had actually used. Now, this was a big feature for me for one reason, for one reason, which is that it reduced the step. Before, and one of the things that you still can do is you can buy a dedicated GPS recorder. It's basically just a little electronic device. It can be very small, and the battery can last probably something along the lines of 24 hours or something like that. What it will do is it will just continuously record your track whenever it's on in a very similar fashion to this. And then you can go home, connect it to your computer, download the track, and do all these sorts of things. But it wasn't really, that wasn't something that I did a lot. I didn't like to plug it in. I didn't like to remember to have to charge this separate device and actually carry the separate device. I ended up forgetting it all the time. So having this all in one device on the smartphone has really lowered the barrier to entry for this. So now you have this track of GPS coordinates that actually shows the path that you took during a hike or during a trip, while perhaps on a road trip or what have you, as you actually walk around with your camera. And there's a way that you can import this track into your photo editing software, especially if you're using Lightroom or Aperture. You can import the tracks and associate that information with the photographs. So you'll notice that here on the right side of this screen, I can download the GPX or KML files. These are standards. These are standard types of files that specify GPS coordinates for a track. Now, the example that I'm going to show you is related to Lightroom. And so what I will do here, I just happen to know that for Lightroom, it needs the GPX. So I'll click on that, and it will download the GPX track. And we can actually look at this track. This is not something that's necessary, perhaps, in order to actually truly get all of our information tagged. Oh, let's see, this is not going to show up very pretty here. But this is some of the information. We can just see, essentially, that it's a collection of coordinates and times. And it's this collection of time that's actually really important. Because your camera actually took photographs and recorded a time, even if it doesn't have GPS capability, what you can do is import this track into your software and associate, based on the time, the location that you took that photo. So this is awesome. So far, so good. Except there's a couple of gotchas. One of them is that the time on your camera probably has a time zone, especially if you were traveling, probably has a time zone that is different than the time zone here. Almost always, the time zone on a GPS application is going to be in UTC time, Universal Coordinated Time. And so that means that if you happen to set your camera to your local time zone, you're probably going to have to do some trickery to adjust the time zone in either the track or in your photos to make sure that those times match and actually associate the photos properly. Frankly, this is the hardest part about all of these things. So far, all the software has gotten really good to the point where it's now very easy to download the track. I don't have to have anything else except the phone, which I would have with me anyway. And I would have to set my camera's time properly, but that's all stuff that I would do anyway. But really, this is the most difficult aspect of this technique. So what you can do in Lightroom is when you go to the maps, and again, we're showing Lightroom, but this is possible in Aperture. I've also done it in Aperture and perhaps other photo organization software as well, but really these are sort of the two major ones that we're going to be talking about now. If you go to the map, there is a little icon down here below the map, looks like a little squiggly line, and when you hover your mouse, it says GPS track logs. You can load a track log, and specifically, we'll load the one that we had just downloaded. And there, now we've imported this track that we had created with our phone into this software. And again, although I was recommending Gaia GPS, there's probably others. Really, what you want is for that software to be able to export standard GPS track logs. Usually, you might be able to convert from one to the X, but from one to the other. But having this GPX style coordinates or this GPX style format will make it a little bit easier for you when you're importing into Lightroom. Now from here, it actually specifies some things like the time and some other things. And you can actually apply by selecting a wide variety of photos. You can select all of the photos in your sequence here. So for now, because my track log only covered a certain number of of days. This track log only covered a certain number of photos, even though this entire sequence of photos spanned perhaps 3 weeks worth of photos. And so I have many different track logs. I can select the photos that I want and select the photos on, or auto tag the photos. Now you'll notice that there's a set time zone offset. You probably will have to try a couple of times to get the time zone offset correct. The first attempt should be to actually figure out the difference between your local time zone and UTC. So for those of us here in the East Coast, right now during daylight savings, it happens to be off by 5 hours. But that will actually change. Because UTC doesn't observe daylight savings, that will actually change in just a few weeks here. So one of the things that I recommend is on your camera, set your time on the camera to UTC. This actually solves a number of problems. One of them is this track log issue, although there is usually still some trickery because sometimes apparently what happens is that that Lightroom interprets the GPS track log. From what I can tell, this may not be correct. From what I can tell, it seems that Lightroom, at least the version that I was using, interprets the track log in terms of the current computer's local time. And so I had converted UTC, the camera's photos from UTC to Pacific time because I was in the Pacific time zone. And then I tried to do the track log here in Eastern time, and I noticed that they were all about 3 hours off. And so that was sort of one of the difficulties that I had there. But by setting your camera's time to UTC, you actually solve a number of problems. One of them is that most likely if you go on a trip, you forget to change the time on your camera. And that's really frustrating when you go and you realize that it looks like you took all these photos at 3 a.m., but it's bright sunlight outside, and you're like, what? I don't know what time it is. I don't remember what time it is. By setting it to UTC, when you actually return and import those photos, you can then change the time zone after the fact and figure out precisely what the distance or what the difference will be from that time zone to the next. The other is that it does simplify perhaps a little bit this GPS track log, unless it happens to be sort of a stupid issue like this where it might be misinterpreting one of these. So anyway, by doing all of this, you can then place all of your photos on a track and you can know precisely where you were when you exported or when you took this photo. And when you export this photo, if you preserve the location metadata, this GPS information will be preserved within your image, and online sites like SmugMug or Flickr might actually show it on a map, which is kind of neat as well. Now, there's a couple of other things that I want to show you, actually. When you're using an app like this, particularly on an iPhone, you really need to do some things to save the battery. So even if you're on an Android phone or on any device where you're going to be using this GPS tracker, one of the things that you want to do is disable everything but the GPS itself. So specifically, if you're on a hike like this, which is out in the wilderness, and there's certainly going to be no cell phone towers, one of the phone's highest power states, so its highest usage, is actually trying to find cell phone towers. So by disabling the phone's cellular network connection but keeping the GPS alive, you will maximize the amount of battery life that your phone will have. So if you're on an Android device, you are probably fortunate enough to have independent control over the GPS power and the network power. So turn off Wi-Fi, turn off Bluetooth, turn off cellular data, but keep GPS on your Android device, and you'll maximize the power when using one of these, some of this software. On an iPhone, we don't really have that same luxury. Putting it on airplane mode turns off essentially the power to all of those same things, but it also turns off power to GPS, and we don't have an independent control over GPS. Perhaps in some future update that will change, but for now that's not the case. So there's a couple of things that we can do, which I do want to show you here as well. So essentially we can replicate airplane mode by turning off Wi-Fi, for example, by going into the cellular network and turning off cellular data and turning off roaming and turning off all the voice, everything. Now what this will do is you'll notice in the upper left-hand corner that it's still connected to a network, but it's now not going to be trying to connect to a data network. And so this will, in fact, minimize as much as possible the usage of the phone's battery while you're using one of these GPS trackers. Any questions on that? Yes.
Work only in the US or will it work in Siberia and Mongolia?
this GPS, the GPS tracker will work anywhere because it receives, the way that it works is that it receives signals from satellites that surround the Earth. And so long as your phone has clear sight of the sky, then you will be able to receive satellite signals anywhere on the Earth and it will record the GPS coordinates. So what happens here is that I now need internet access here so that I can actually see the map. And what it will do is it will place those coordinates on the map itself, but a good GPS app won't actually need access to the internet because it's just not necessary. And in fact, many GPS apps will in fact tell you how good of a connection or how good, so here's one thing that we will see. Many of these GPS apps will, in fact, give you some help to try to increase the accuracy. This is something that the iPhone tells you. Turning on Wi-Fi will improve location accuracy, but that's not going to help you at all if there's no Wi-Fi in the middle of the wilderness. So if I click OK on that, one of the windows up here is we can actually see the accuracy of the GPS down here. So even though I don't have line of sight in the sky, I do have some amount of accuracy. It's not super great. You can see the GPS accuracy is plus or minus 200 feet. So plus or minus about 62 meters or something like that. And it does show us the approximate GPS location and the latest connection. There's also a little bar up top that shows you how good of a connection it is. I've never seen it perfect, even when I'm outside and I'm holding it up and there's nothing around, but it tends to be pretty good with an accuracy of about, I don't know, a couple meters really at the best. But still, that's really all we want, is we want to an approximation to our true location. Any questions on this? Now, for those of you that use apps like Instagram or Facebook or Twitter on your smartphone, this is precisely the same way that all of these things are able to use the location information, particularly if you use the photo app in your smartphone. So if you bring up the photo app, for example, as soon as you take a picture, it will record the GPS information automatically into the photograph like we were talking about before. And that does simplify the step of having to use this separate GPS tracker app or any similar thing. But as you know, there are downsides to using perhaps your phone's camera rather than having a separate dedicated camera. All right, any questions on this before we move on? Okay, so geocoding is neat, and it is a way that we can apply a lot of information, a lot of additional metadata to our photos. But perhaps now we've gone home and we actually want to start modifying our photos. And a lot of you hopefully have some experience by now actually taking a photo in a raw mode on your camera and importing it into some software like Photoshop or Lightroom or some other raw processor and actually processing that particular image. But just in case that is not the case, I just want to quickly go over a couple of things related to this. So here I have Photoshop. I know you can't see it. Hold on one second. Here I have Photoshop. And here I have a raw file that is rather old at this point, and I've dragged it into Photoshop, and I get this lovely window. Now, a lot of the settings that appear here, even though I'm using Photoshop as an example, do apply to a wide variety of software as well. You'll notice a lot of settings that we actually have. Some of the ones that I do want to point out are the ones that are down here. So let's zoom in on these. Adobe RGB 1998. 8-bit, it does show me the resolution of this file and also the pixels per inch. Now, the pixels per inch are really only relevant if we are going to print this photograph. It says to the printer essentially how much resolution we actually want on a given area. Now, in this case, we're talking about inches, but that might also apply this would certainly also apply in metric as well, but usually you would see a resolution for print in something along the lines of pixels per inch. Now, what's neat is that we can click on this and actually modify a lot of these settings. And we're going to talk a lot more about color spaces, but realize that now there are two major ones that we're really going to be dealing with. One of them is Adobe RGB, and the other one is sRGB. And sRGB has this sort of wild-looking extension. For the vast majority of our photos, we're going to use sRGB. Don't worry about the rest for now, but if you're doing anything on the web, if you're sending a photo to your family, if you decide to posted to the web or anything along those lines, sRGB is generally going to be the one that you want. Generally, you would use other color spaces when we're actually going to talk about printing these out. So once we're actually printing out these photos, then we'll start dealing with other color spaces. But for now, deal with sRGB, and we'll talk about some of the others and what the differences are and what a color space actually is in the colors lecture in just a few weeks. Depth, 8 bits per channel. Hopefully this is now something that looks a little bit familiar. We talked about this already twice now when we were saying that there's individual color channels, red, green, and blue. Normally, we have 8 bits worth of information in each one of these channels for 24 bits of total information at each individual pixel. So in other words, we're representing how many values in each channel. How many discrete values of red, green, and blue do we have individually? 8 bits is the same as a byte, which is the same as 256 discrete values. Yeah, so it goes from 0 to 255, which are 256 discrete values, which doesn't sound like very much, but when you have 256 values of red times 256 values of green times 256 values of blue, multiply all those together, you get millions and millions of different possible colors that you can actually display. All of those are dictated by the color space, but again, we'll talk more about that later. So if you want more than that, so let's say that you're actually going to be doing a significant number of modifications to your image, particularly to its color, or particularly to its exposure, especially if you're going to be doing any sort of high dynamic range work, HDR work, particularly if you're going to be doing any sort of compositing or really extreme manipulations to the curves or to the contrast, all of which we'll be talking about in just a moment, then you would want a higher bit depth. But generally, and especially when you actually output an image to your friends and to your family, 8 bits per channel is really all you need. For now, I would recommend keeping your image at the maximum size. You can certainly resize it at a later point, but perhaps just for processing, what we actually want to do is keep the image at its maximum size. Output sharpening. Ooh, this might actually be something good that we can add to this. We'll talk more about sharpening and why we would want to do this and how we can actually achieve it, perhaps if we have some time at the end. And that's pretty much it for these options for now. So let's hit OK on this, because I did actually want to output sRGB as my color space, because again, I'm going to be using this for display on the web and not actually printing it out. Now there's a wide variety of options that we have on the right. You've probably played with a lot of these, like the white balance. We'll talk more about what white balance actually means and why it's a measure of temperature in the color lecture. But you can just sort of play with it until you get to the point where you feel that it is actually correct. You can, of course, also use some tools available to try to select individual regions of the image that should dictate precisely the white balance that you want. For example, the white balance tool. This looks different in any software that you use, but it's generally an eyedropper. You click on it, and you click on an area that should be a middle gray in terms, not in terms of the tone, not in terms of how black or white it is, but in terms of the color. You want it to be a gray color. So in this case, I would argue that the spray coming from the water is, in fact, the middle gray that we want. Click on that. This is maybe a good first start for our color to actually manipulate this image. But perhaps we actually want to modify it a little bit so we can adjust the color temperature as needed. Now, exposure allows us to modify the exposure values that we should have set originally when we first took the image, but we can do it after we had actually captured the image. And we do actually have quite a bit of latitude in the exposure, particularly when we are talking about a raw file. You generally have about 2 stops of latitude, I would say, at the most, on either end when you're dealing with a raw file that you can reasonably use in a high-quality photograph. This might vary from camera to camera, certainly will vary from camera to camera, and you would probably find that you have less latitude on the upper end. So in other words, if you have overexposed something and you try to decrease its exposure value in software, you might find that you'll have a much harder time than you will taking a dark image and trying to make it brighter. We'll talk more about why that is in the upcoming weeks as well. But generally about 2 stops is really the limit to what you can do. But even within that, I will regularly adjust my images by about a stop or so, because in the moment, I might have gotten the exposure incorrect, and never again will I be in the same position to actually take that same moment in time, capture that same moment in time. All right, now one of the very interesting things about digital cameras is that they capture light in a very linear fashion. And blah, 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 we'll talk about this at a later day, what this actually means. But really what contrast is it maps essentially those linear values to a tone curve that is then displayed on the screen. So in other words, it takes the middle tones and it makes them more important. And it's sort of, it's meant to replicate the way that our vision system works. When we look at a scene, we don't really see everything in a linear response. It might look linear to us, but it's not really a linear response. The things that we are, our eyes are exposing for, if you will, are sort of the middle grays, so that we can actually see everything, see all of the contrast in the scene at those middle grays, and everything in the very bright regions and everything in the very dark regions fall off in terms of importance. And a similar thing happens with contrast. And we can adjust that. And in fact, I'll show you in just a few minutes when we talk about tone curve, I can show you how the contrast can actually, we can actually manipulate the curve itself to actually manipulate the contrast. But many of you probably have seen and have played with contrast, especially turning it way, way up or turning it way, way down to sort of really change the look of your image. Similarly, we can do things with saturation and all sorts of other things. But one of the things that I did want to talk about was vibrance. I think we might also call it like vivid or something along these lines. Now, saturation, it's related to saturation. So let me pause that discussion on vibrance for just a second to talk about saturation. Saturation is basically how saturated the colors will be. So by increasing the saturation, it is in fact distinct from contrast, because notice that I can increase the saturation to make the colors quite a bit more, well, they pop a lot more. There, you can notice those colors, that increases the saturation of those particular colors. Fortunately, it's kind of difficult. It's like when you look up a word in the dictionary and it says the definition is itself, or is another word, and then that you go to that word, and then it says that that definition is the original word. It's the best I can do. Okay, so saturation really is increasing the, we are increasing the saturation of all of the colors within that, and that this is in fact distinct and unique from contrast. Now, Adobe has some proprietary sliders as well. Saturation and contrast you will find in pretty much any software that allows you to manipulate images. Even on your phone, you'll generally have some contrast and saturation sliders. Across Adobe's products, they have increased and included this feature in recent years called vibrance or vivid or some word along these lines. And this does actually impact the saturation, but it does it in a proprietary way. And I don't think there's been any sort of official discussion from Adobe about what this actually does, but based on analyses that people have done online and just sort of looking at it, if you try to modify the vibrance of an image yourself, you'll notice that it tends to do two things. And these may or may not be truly accurate, but we can sort of think of it in this way and as a rule of thumb when we're modifying our images with these sliders. One of them is that it will try to increase the saturation of everything in the image except skin tones, so that you don't make people look like they have a spray tan, like I've done to this gentleman here in the image, by increasing the contrast to such a degree that his skin tone has now been altered. So if I decrease the saturation here and try to increase the vibrance, we might see that that is in fact the case. So I'll do this manipulation one more time, turn down the vibrance, increase the saturation. We can see how I've sort of modified. If you focus particularly on the gentleman's skin, you'll notice that it does in fact change the saturation on that skin when I use the saturation slider, but not the vibrance slider. Now, the other thing that it tries to do is if you have color that are already well saturated, it tries not to make it oversaturated. Now, this is a lot more subjective, but it generally is the case that when I'm using Adobe products, I'll generally mess with the vibrance slider first, see if it gets me to a good place, and then maybe bump up the saturation as a whole. So really, one then in vibrance or vivid is really a way of manipulating these things in sort of in a little bit smarter of a means. Any questions on this? Now, there's a lot of other options that are available. A lot of mirrorless cameras, for example, just as an example, a lot of mirrorless cameras, in order to make the bodies of the lenses and the bodies of the cameras much smaller, is they do perhaps cut some corners. And by that I mean they cut some optical quality corners. And this doesn't really matter too much. If you were to take a look at the raw image, they're still very high quality images, but they're perhaps not as high quality. Could be argued that they're not as high quality as the most expensive lenses that you could get. Maybe this makes sense. But one of the things that these cameras do rely on is embedding some metadata within the image that specifies precisely what lens and what camera body was actually used to capture that image. And products like Adobe, Photoshop, and Lightroom do actually leverage this to modify the look of an image based on the properties of that lens. So of the many features that we can actually manage, of the many things that we can actually manage within a particular image, one of them are these sort of, calibrations for the lenses and for the cameras that might allow us to fix some of the problems within our image. And I just mentioned this as an example of some of the many things that you can do, but realize that if you do have like a mirrorless camera, there might be some calibration for your lenses that allow you to improve the look of your images without needing to worry about buying other lenses. Now, this isn't a fix-all, of course, but it does fix some of the distortions and some other problems that arise because of issues with the lenses. All right, so let's come back to this image here, which I now have to fix again. Whoops, I had about a plus 2/3 exposure, and I increased the contrast a fair amount on this thing, and then I also increased the vibrance quite a bit, and maybe the saturation just a little bit. And so now, after our discussion about the histogram, you hopefully are able to take a look at this and now figure out a lot more information about this particular image. Arguably, the spray in the water, it should be relatively white, so perhaps I haven't increased the exposure enough. Maybe I actually need to increase it even more to make the image even more correct. And I would say that that looks pretty good, so I'll go ahead and open the image. All right, so we've talked about smartphones, geocoding, contrast, saturation, vibrance, and there's a few other things that are related to some of these topics that we've already talked about that are, in fact, very useful. Levels, for example, and the tone curve do actually allow us to modify this idea of the contrast, this contrast tone curve that modifies the look of our image. So within our within Photoshop, we can actually open up any one of these additional menus to provide this information to us. So here, I just want to make sure that all is well here. Image, and let's see. I've gotten incredibly lazy in recent years, and I have forgotten the location of just about everything in menus. Ever since Apple introduced this feature in the help menu, which allows you to sort of search for a specific item in the menus, I just use this all the time. It's terrible. So I want to find levels. Oh, there it is, adjustment levels. All right. And I think it makes me seem like I don't know where stuff is, but hey, that's the way it goes. So here it is, levels. This basically shows you a copy of the histogram, and it allows you to adjust a variety of things. One of them, so notice that we have basically three sliders underneath the histogram. And there are a variety of things that each of these actually does. The very far left slider, for instance, specifies the tone that should be pure black. The one on the far right specifies the tone that should be pure white. And the tone in the middle, or the slider in the middle, specifies the tone that should be this middle gray in terms of exposure. So let's see what happens when we actually modify each of these. Let me take the white slider and slide it down, for instance, and observe what happens to the image. Things seem to be getting brighter and brighter and brighter. And the reason for this is that I am saying that everything at this tone, where the slider is pointing, and to the right, should become pure white. So I'm essentially brightening the image by saying that all of these tones should now be pure white. Now, I've actually done a fair amount of modification to this image and gotten the histogram to a point that I think is actually pretty reasonable for this particular image. But I could still do some minor modifications by adjusting the white point to be really, really close to where the data appears to start. And so in this manner, I can then use my histogram as a way of saying, okay, well now I know that I want to make the spray, the ocean spray, nearly pure white without actually exceeding that limitation. And I've done that by adjusting the slider just a few values to the left. You might recall that the original value here was in fact 255, just like we've been talking about all this time. All right, 245 here. Now similarly, can I adjust the black value? But unless I find the regions of this image that are particularly dark, which are probably the hair and the back of the board here, it's going to be more difficult to sort of see the result there. But basically what I'm doing is I'm increasing the black point, and what I'm saying is that these values, now everything at this slider and to the left, should be the new black. And so this can be really useful when you actually want to compress the scene, the range, the total range of the scene, so that it actually fills all of the available values. This is a great way of actually increasing the apparent contrast of the scene and really making your image pop. But doing it in a way that is a bit more methodical than just taking the contrast slider and increasing it or decreasing it and sort of having to look at the histogram and make sure that you get it just right, I still adjust the contrast, as you saw, but then I go back and refine using either levels or curves the black point and the white point to be precisely where I want it to be. Now, in all of my manipulation, perhaps the middle gray is no longer in the right place. Very similar to the other ones, moving this middle gray slider then dictates what should be the new value of 128. So I can slide this around and we can see what actually happens to this image as I modify that. Sometimes I actually want to provide more emphasis to certain tones, and by moving this slider I can then do that. So let me uncheck preview so that you can actually see the before image, which now looks like it just has slightly less contrast, and the after image, which now appears to have slightly more, but also it appears to have changed the tone of the man here and seems to have exposed him perhaps a little bit better. By that I'm talking in terms of exposure in photographic terms. Okay. So let me cancel this, because there's another way that we can accomplish all of this as well, which does look a little bit more intimidating, but it is not, in fact, any more complicated to understand. So in adjustments curves, again, I'm using my little trick here to find it, we get this graph, which is now slightly more complicated, but bear with me for just a moment. This still shows the histogram, and we get to see now two axes. We get to adjust two axes. One of them is the input. So in other words, these are all of the values as they currently exist in the image. At the far left, we have values that are zero, or pure black. At the far right, we have values that are white, or 255. And then we have on the vertical axis the output. So what we are saying by being able to adjust this line, which right now is linear, it's this linear line that goes from 0, 0 all the way to 255, 255, by adjusting this line, we can say that we want to map values that used to be at some particular location to some other location. And so this provides us even more control, perhaps. Well, in some ways, this provides us more control than specifying the black point and the white point. I still can, in fact, set the black point and the white point by actually dragging each of the sliders as we had done in levels. So we still haven't lost that information. So here we have the input. I want to drag my slider all the way a little bit to the left. It's about 240, which is about where we had it before. But notice what has happened. We're saying that values that used to be 240 at the input are now a value of 255 at the output. This is precisely what we had just done in levels, but it's just showing us all of this in a little bit more information. It's just giving us just a little bit finer control over this same thing. I can do the same thing for the black point, increase it just slightly until we get to approximately the same level of contrast enhancement that we had before. I haven't yet manipulated the middle tones, but I can show you how to do that in just 1 second. So you'll notice there's a bunch of other stuff here. Generally, I don't really touch on it, But it does provide some ways of sort of getting additional information here. Seeing the histogram is generally a pretty useful thing. Showing the channel overlays, I guess, doesn't really matter unless you're manipulating individual color channels, which sometimes you might, in fact, want to do. But this curves allows us to see what happens when we adjust the tone curve. So one of the things that might be confusing is that I had just talked a few minutes ago about how photographs are taken in a linear input, and there's a tone curve that's applied to it, and we'll talk more about the tone curve in the digital camera lecture. There's a tone curve that's applied to it that gives importance to middle values. But we don't see that tone curve here. This is an extra curve that's applied on top of that application that has already occurred. In a few lectures, we'll actually see what a linear photo looks like, and in fact, it's really dark. It just looks dark. And that's because the vast majority of the values happen to be at the very low end. And we'll talk about why that is, blah, 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 later on. But the tone curve has already been applied, so we are applying an extra curve to this image. So I just wanted to sort of clear that up now, and we will hopefully make it even more clear a little bit later. Now, one of the ways to increase contrast here is to, in fact, make some of these midtones a little bit brighter, make some of the highlights a little bit brighter, maybe not too much. You can see I might have overdone it a little bit, and make the dark areas a little bit darker. So making the curve, giving it a little bit of this sort of S shape, whereas before it was linear, is what is this aspect that I was referring to before, where I'm providing more precedence to these middle tones. So think about what's happening to this in terms of this context of input along the bottom and output on the left. If I move the shadows down a little bit, what I am doing is, and by moving the shadows down here and by increasing the highlights there, what I am doing is that I am taking this area, which used to be, you know, this collection of values, and I'm spreading them out further on the output. So I'm saying that these tones are sort of the most important tones in this image, and I'm squashing the highlights and I'm squashing the shadows and allowing those middle tones to really come out in the image. And this has the effect of increasing the contrast in the image. So if I turn off the preview, we can sort of see what has happened. If I do the opposite, it appears that I am decreasing contrast. In fact, there's a certain point where if you get where you can start inverting tones, if you want to see that, let's just go crazy here. I want to invert the tones, so I'll just start over. There are ways to, in fact, There are, in fact, ways to add additional points and remove points, but I do this just to make it a little bit simpler. If I invert tones and say that everything that was white should now be black and everything that was black should now be white, I've now just done a pure inversion of all of these tones. But undoing that and increasing the contrast, or rather removing some of these, removing that S curve a little bit, we can see that we do in fact decrease the contrast just a tad before we get to some trouble points where we've now mapped, we've now created this inversion in the middle here where we've mapped some tones that should be brighter to some tones that should be darker and vice versa. This is just in general, a bad thing. But generally, adding a little bit more of an S to this curve is what you want when you want to increase the contrast just a little bit more. You can also specify that by using the values down here and down here in the bottom of this window. Any questions on levels, tone curve? So I realized that some of the backing behind understanding all of these, we haven't yet quite gone over, but we will in the upcoming lectures. I'm mentioning these now. It's sort of there's sort of a tension here. We want to be able to show some of this early enough so that you can actually use it, particularly for Project 3 and for Project 4 as well. But realize that some of this that we'll have to sort of delay before we can actually go into detail when we talk about it in upcoming weeks. Let's take a quick 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll tackle the right side of our to-do list. All right, hello everyone. Welcome back. So before the break, we managed to get through everything on the left side here, but there are still a few more things that I do want to discuss before we finish for today. One of them are layers and adjustment layers, masking, these sorts of techniques that you would typically find in Photoshop more so than in other raw processors. Just to make it a little bit more clear, a lot of the techniques that I've shown up until now, particularly when discussing contrast, saturation, levels, tone curve, you can in fact do in a raw processor. I was just using Photoshop just as an example, but again, you can use this in Lightroom or in Aperture or in any other raw processor. They generally have tools that are very similar to each of these that we've talked about. Now, when we're talking about layers, essentially what we're saying is that we have an image where we can add additional layers on top of them. So imagine that you have a printout of an image, and an additional layer is like taking a piece of transparency. If you remember old school transparent papers when we had a back in elementary school, and they put transparency and then they'd be able to write on it. That's essentially what we're talking about, placing a piece of transparency, being able to write on that, or to doodle, or to draw, or to place another photograph without actually modifying the underlying image. And this is a very important tactic when we're talking about this concept of non-destructive editing. When we actually want to create edits and modifications to an image without modifying the bits underlying it that actually represent it. This is useful because perhaps one day we will actually want to go back to our original image and perform an alternate modification. One relevant example is if you wanted to create multiple versions of an image. For example, perhaps you want to post an image online and you modify it in such a way that it looks perfect for screens. And then you modify it a slightly different way so that it looks great for print. You modify it a slightly different way so that it can actually be used in some other context as well. You want to have the original bits that make up that image so that you don't have to keep undoing your original or keep undoing additional modifications and modify and adjust and destroy some of the work and the data that you've worked hard to actually achieve. Now, so for sort of the next few minutes, what we're going to be talking about our layers and adjustment layers, we're going to be using Ralph Wiggum here from Simpsons fame as an example of this. Now, all of these three things are sort of related, and they're at least going to be related in the context of this discussion, but realize that you can do each of these independently and to get results out of your photo editing that you might actually want to achieve. So layers is the ability to add additional pixels to your image, but on top of your image without actually destroying the original image there. So one example of this could be if I were to come back to this image here, and let's just say that I'm going to do a very poor job at painting. I could actually just do some doodling here, for example, but because I've actually done this directly on the image, I've actually modified this image itself. I've modified the pixels that make up this image directly, and this is perhaps not what I want. Typically in Photoshop, you have one of the palettes up available called the Layers Palette. If you don't, it's under the Window menu that allows you to bring the layers palette up. And notice that at this point, I only have one layer. I can create a new layer by clicking the New Document. It's sort of the paper with the folded paper icon at the bottom. I now have a new layer, and it is this layer that I can now modify. Oops, I accidentally hit something to change the color. And now by hiding that layer, I can actually see that I still have preserved my original file. As you get more complicated, you'll add additional layers, and you can even add folders to organize those layers. This can be useful for a variety of contexts. Now, there's a lot of things that we actually see that are options here. So we can adjust this pull down. It says normal, and there's a variety of options here. Essentially, what this does is tells you how this layer is going to merge with the layers underneath it. Normal just means that those pixels are going to completely overlay the pixels that make up the bottom layer. If I were to, and to make this a little bit more clear, if I were to hide the underlying layer, notice that what happened is that I have sort of removed the image and I see this checkered background, which is Photoshop's way of saying this is transparent. This is basically just a representation for transparent pixels, but we can see that I my painting here, my lovely doodle, has in fact persisted in this image. But anyway, what this allows me to do is to adjust how these pixels are combined with the pixels from the underlying layers to adjust the final look. Now, it's not going to be terribly clear if I were to actually adjust this now what's going on, but I just want to point it out, and we'll talk a little bit more as we modify Ralph Wiggum into some images. There's opacity. This is perhaps the clearest thing to understand. We can actually adjust the opacity of the layer itself. Notice as I decrease the opacity, my doodles seem to disappear a little bit more into the background, which is useful for blending and a variety of other techniques. If you have layers because you want to add additional text, perhaps you have some text layers, for example, some things that you might find handy are the little FX button down here, which adds layer effects. And some things like inner glow, for example, or outer glow allow you to, the window appeared over here, allow you to provide some effects to your to that individual layer. And I just want to point this out. You can play with it at home. I don't want to spend too much time going over each of these. Certainly look them up online if you're interested in this. But if you wanted to have a text layer with a fancy drop shadow, this is basically the way that you would effectively do it, is create a layer of text and add some effects to that layer that allow you to have some drop down, or maybe you can create some fancy 3D word art by increasing the inner shadow or the bezel or of that text layer. All right, so then from layers we have adjustment layers. And what adjustment layers are is they're a special form of layers that allow you to make these modifications that we had just talked about in a non-destructive way. So whereas before we'd actually modified directly the contrast, the saturation, the tone, or the levels and the tone curve of this image, what I really should have done was, rather than modify those pixels, was to create an adjustment layer that allows me to non-destructively do this. You can do this by going up to the Layers menu and creating a new adjustment layer and picking any one of the modifications that you would actually want, including exposure, brightness, contrast levels. Now, all of this assumes that you have already processed the raw file into some number of bits. And again, if you're going to be doing lots of modification to your image, particularly to contrast or to saturation or to exposure, you want to have processed that file into higher bits than just 8 bits per channel. 16 bits per channel or so will help you preserve all of that data as much as possible. But let's see what happens when I actually increase or adjust the curves, perhaps, in an adjustment layer for this image. It brings up this menu, which basically allows me to set options for the layer. Just want to give it a name or what have you. The defaults are fine for now. And I can, in fact, notice that what I have here is a new adjustment layer. It looks like there's a little chain icon, there's a little contrast icon, and there's a white box. Now, what this is actually saying is that this white box is a mask, and we'll talk more about masking in just a minute, but if we double-click on this icon, this little half-moon icon, this brings up that adjustment that we had been working with before. Well, I guess it's already up here. In this case, it brought it up as a palette instead of a separate window, but really it's the same tool that we had just been working with. I can adjust the curves of this image. I want to increase the contrast a little bit, like I had just done, by making that linear line, by making that line a little bit more, have a little bit more of an S-curve to it. And I might be pleased with this. I'd be like, sweet, I have a cool little doodle here. I've increased the contrast, so now everybody's going to love this image. Now I'm ready to save this image. Now, what's great about this, though, is that once you've saved this image, because you've done this in a non-destructive way, you have several options. One, you can hide your modification and see what the original image looked like without actually having done that modification. And two, you can actually go back and change your modifications at a later point without having to undo all of your prior changes. So adjustment layers are really the way to go for a lot of these things once you've processed your image out of the raw format. If you do further modifications, I heavily recommend using this adjustment. Now, this white box is, in fact, a mask. And it is, I realize we're sort of jumping around a little bit here, but all of these are somewhat connected, even though we can use them independently. A mask basically just specifies to what degree we want this layer to apply to the underlying layers. So in other words, imagine that we take this transparency that used to be square or rectangular, and we had overlaid it on top of our image, and this transparency is maybe tinted yellow or something, just for the sake of example. We've tinted this transparency yellow so that it looks like our photo now has a yellow tint to it. But rather than apply that to the entire image, perhaps we really only want to apply that to a certain portion of the image. So what you would do in this analogy is take the transparency off, take some scissors, cut away, put it back on, and you've essentially created a mask. What you did was you took portions of that layer, of that filter, and applied it to only certain portions within the image. So by using the mask, we can adjust precisely where we want this modification to happen. So we might have taken this image and realized that, wow, we've kind of like this over-contrasty look of the wave and of the spray of the water, but I really don't like the over-contrast look that I've applied to the surfer. Now, for the sake of prettiness, I'm going to get rid of that ugly layer. So I can, in fact, adjust this mask by clicking on it and by using a brush tool, which has already been selected by default as I clicked on the mask. The brush tool has been selected. And you'll notice that because this is white, this is saying that this mask is basically a grayscale representation of values. So it goes from value of 0 all the way up to 255. Any values that are 0 means that this layer does not apply. In other words, this filter is not going to apply. Any values that are white or value of 255, this layer will fully apply. And you have a range of things in between, which means that you can sort of paint a very smooth gradient and make your adjustments very smooth. All right, so here we can see if I perhaps want to adjust. Is there a way for me to, let's see, no, okay. Now, if I want to adjust this, I'm going to first change my brush size to be something a little bit more reasonable. That's perhaps a little bit more reasonable. And I'm going to set the color of my brush to be black. Notice that I have a color palette here on the far left. Right now, there's two colors. There's a foreground color and a background color. The foreground color is currently black, which means that I'll be able to use my brush to paint a black tone to this image. And then I will start to apply image portions of this image that I don't want my adjustment to take place. Oops, this is actually the inverse of what I want. I said that I wanted to remove this adjustment on the guy here, so I'm just adjusting the mask for my adjustment, and I'm doing kind of a poor job. I would adjust the size of the brush and do this with a bit more finesse if I were actually doing this somewhat seriously. But now we can see something very cool, that our mask has been updated with only that area that I had modified. Now you might be saying, well, this is kind of small, I can kind of see what I'm doing, but not really. It is, in fact, possible to adjust just the mask itself by option clicking on a Mac, or I might be alt clicking on a Windows machine and alt option clicking on a Mac. You hold down that one button, click on the mask, and it shows you just that mask and allows you to modify it in whatever additional finesse that you want. So we can see I've missed the spot here. Now I'll just sort of paint that in and do any adjustments. And then just by clicking away from that mask, can I then see the results of my work. I can, of course, hide then my layer and see that the before and after of what I've done. Now I've really made this spray very contrasty and very colorful without really changing too much the tone of the man's skin. So in essence, what we've done is covered these three things: layers, adjustment layers, and masking. But there's a lot of power behind each of these, which I want to show you in this example of Ralph Wiggum. By the way, this sort of the perfect example of if you kind of get bored and just start playing around with your computer, maybe it will actually be useful. I remember one day I was really, really bored, and I had a computer that was using the standard Apple backgrounds, which were, you know, they're very nice, they're very pretty, but I was getting bored of them and I wanted something a little bit better. So I spent a few hours one day deciding that I really wanted to embed Ralph into these images. So I decided that I would use these techniques to try to do it in a somewhat, well, hopefully somewhat decent job. So let's see, we have this image here, where Ralph is present over there. Okay, wait, there's a few more. There's the dewdrop, where Ralph is now in the dewdrop. There's the Earth Horizon, where he's, you know, king of the world over here, grass blades, he's sort of embedded. People think this one's a little creepy, maybe. Here he is sort of overwatching the, you know, the lightning. Here he is, you know, Ralph for president, 2008, you know, so on and so forth. Standing on a pier, pond reeds, so on and so forth. So how is all of this actually done? Well, I found this image on the internet of Ralph back in 2008, I guess, there was a Simpsons episode where he was running for president and his platform was Stranger Danger and some other rather humorous things, and decided to cut him out of this using masking techniques to be able to then apply him to images elsewhere. Now, masking is more than just applying a specific mask to a layer. We can also use masking to select portions of a layer that we can then copy only those pixels. There's a couple of different ways we can do this. You might be familiar with like the simple marquee tools, for example, which allow us to select regions of an image using rectangular marquee, or perhaps you've used like the lasso, which allows us to specify arbitrary shapes that are then highlighted, or perhaps you've even used something like the magnetic lasso tool, which is in fact the thing that I used for Ralph, to try to get precisely the region that we actually want. And it tries to do this. Basically, the way it works is that it looks for areas of local contrast, and if it exceeds some value for local contrast, it will follow that particular path, and we can try to get some region of our image actually captured this way. But the way that masking actually allows us to take all of this idea is if you have selected initially some region of the image and hit the Q key, you get what's called a quick mask. And what this shows you is very much the same thing. This is a quick mask showing you what portions of the image are actually highlighted. In this case, the portions of the image that are red are not highlighted, and the portions that are not red are highlighted. So the portions that you see normally are in fact highlighted. And so you can use this along with the brush tool again so that you can get very nice, soft selection of a region of an image without this sort of harshness that you can see existed in the borders when I was using these lasso tools. So using this quick mask, I can then adjust my selection in this way by using the brush tool. And of course, you would do this in a little bit better of a way if you were actually doing this somewhat seriously. When I hit Q again, I can see that there is a region of the image that's in fact now highlighted, and I can copy and paste that into a layer on another image. So I can create a new image here, just as an example, paste, let's see, create a new layer. Oh my gosh, what happened to my, it's way too small. I think I might have made this a little bit too small. Oh man, I can't see where the data is. That's fine. Create a new layer. Oh, I see. It was just way too big. Let's create something that's about 300 by 300 pixels. That should be fine. And paste. Oh no. Oh, maybe I didn't copy it. Select that, copy, go here, paste, and I have somewhere, where is my, oh my gosh, all right, failure number two has occurred. Oh wait, there it is. I see something in the layer, but because of craning my neck, can't do it. Anyway, rest assured that this worked. This is why some of these are in fact prepackaged. Basically what we have in the end is, there it is, okay, there's Ralph. Basically this is what resulted. Using this same technique of using the quick mask, basically first sort of getting a crude outline using this lasso tool, switching to the quick mask, using the brushes to really get the edges a lot more precise compared to what I had before. And I have in fact taken Ralph out as a mask with the areas surrounding him transparent, which means that now it's very easy for me to select his layer, which I can do here, select all using either Apple A on Command A on a Mac or Control A on a PC, copying all of these pixels, opening a file that I actually want to modify, and pasting him in there. So just for the sake of example, let's open up this one, Winter Sunrise. So we can see here that we have Ralph in a layer. And that's essentially what happened. Just pasted this mask of Ralph, and a couple of adjustments later, including resizing him to be the proper size and then changing the saturation and just perhaps flipping him over to make the proper adjustments, are in fact all that was necessary to accomplish most of these. Except for some of the more complicated ones, like this one, where it actually looks like he's inside of the dewdrop. If I bring your attention back to those layer dropdowns, we can see that now rather than using a normal combination in layers from the Ralph layer to the subsequent ones, I did a lighten. And basically what this does is it takes all of the pixels that are lighter than the ones underneath it and allows those to shine through. So what this means is that Ralph then only was, I had selected the wrong one. Ralph in this case was normal, but before I had pasted Ralph in, I had actually copied the bubble, the dewdrop itself, and pasted it into a separate layer above Ralph. So it's just essentially this. And the way I was able to achieve that effect is to then say that this bubble, which is now on top of Ralph's layer, I should take all pixels that are in fact lighter than Ralph and allow those to shine through. And anything that's darker should then be transparent. And so what this enables is that the sort of darker region in the middle allowed Ralph to come through, and still the lighter regions sort of look like it masks him. It just happened to be a very fortuitous way of creating this particular effect. But of course, you can do this to a wide variety of images as well, like for example, this one, which is a photo back in my hometown of El Paso of a Sarco Tower, which was a coal factory. I don't remember if they produced electricity or what have you, but it hadn't been in use for many years, and it's been recently torn down. But I had the opportunity to take a photograph of it and decided to add Ralph with some charcoal by using these same techniques. So really then, this is essentially using these techniques, layers, masking, and to a lesser degree, at least for these examples, adjustment layers, and using them for compositing. So we can take multiple layers, we can take multiple pixels from various sources and composite them onto other images in order to make a composite image. So some of the terminology that you will see used on projects or in problem sets, for example, makes a distinction between photographs, which are images that you have captured with your camera, and things that we call images. And images really are meant to be this idea of, they can be a composite of multiple things. It could be a composite of multiple photographs. It could be a composite of an image that you find on the internet, or perhaps a graphic that you find on the internet, and your own photograph. So there really is sort of this distinction that we can make, at least in some technical way, between each of these things. Now, this isn't perhaps the most common type of compositing that you will do. It's really just meant to be sort of a humorous example of how we can use these techniques for compositing. But if we take a look at another image that I have here, which may have resulted marginally in the problems that I was having with Photoshop, we can see that this image is in fact a composite of multiple photographs. So this happened to be in an overpass between New York and Colorado, and I wanted to get sort of like a cool, long exposure shot of all of the cars driving by, and I wanted it to look really busy. You probably remember old school phone books where that would always be, for some reason, the image on the front of the phone book. It was always of a highway with lots of cars on it. Maybe that wasn't for you, but back in El Paso, that was always the image that they seemed to use. And I wanted to try to replicate that a little bit, but there was just not the traffic on this image or on this road to really get that full effect. So what I did was I set the camera on a tripod and took many exposures of this traffic as the sun was actually setting. And so I was able to get the proper exposure then in a single image, but then I figured later on I would layer all of these images on top of each other to try to make it look like there were more cars than there actually were. And even now it doesn't look like to me that there's that many, but before, this was the image. There was really only a couple at a time. So I had this one image, and then I had this other image. Now I was able to composite them both together. Now it's one thing perhaps to just combine the two of them and call it a day, but there was in fact an issue with this. The issue was that because I had taken these perhaps several minutes apart, the sunset in the sky, and in particular the clouds, the movement of the clouds was actually slightly different than it used to be. So if I just layered the two on top of each other, and again, I use this lighten technique because the pixels are really all of the same except for these light pixels that were caused by the cars actually moving by. So I wanted to make sure that the light pixels were the ones that were preserved from the top layer. What I noticed was that there was a weird sort of double vision in the clouds above. So let's see if I can actually disable the mask and zoom in and show you this issue. Let's see, you can see it in there's like a star or a planet perhaps up here. You can see two of them. That's one example of this. I'm pretty sure there was a location in the clouds as well. It was really visible. But anyway, this bothered me because it wasn't, in fact, a perfect overlay. There was some definite overlapping between some of the clouds. I thought for sure that it was over here on the right side of the screen, and perhaps there is some. I would probably have to disable some of the... You can sort of see what's happening. It seems to kind of alter the shape of the clouds. So what I did was, by adding a mask to this particular layer. Let's see, refine mask. And it's under layer, and then you're able to add a mask to it. But I think because I've already added a mask, here it is. Layer mask. You can either reveal all or hide all, and what that means is what of those pixels are actually going to be shown. So reveal all will reveal all of the pixels in that layer. Hide all will do the opposite. But in this case, I then modified the mask to remove the horizon and all of the sky above it, so that only the image or only the sky in the bottommost image would actually show through using this technique. Now, the reason that I did this is that this allowed me to not have to use a mask on each of the individual streaks of light. By using this lighten aspect to take all of the light pixels in this image and overlay them to all of the darker pixels underneath, I didn't have to mask each of the individual strands of light coming from the cars, but it did cause that weird issue in the sky, so I used the mask then to remove all of those pixels from the final combination. So this composite then of these two images sort of combined and got closer to the look that I actually wanted using each of these techniques of having a layer, masking, and compositing. Now, if we were to talk about, if we were to move on from some of these ideas and to talk about HDR, HDR is really a topic that takes, there's probably an entire class worth of information that could go into this, but it's also not a technique that I tend to use very frequently. But sort of the general idea is along similar lines, except a little bit more advanced than this. It is essentially compositing multiple images on top of each other, but really what it's doing is it's taking the raw bits of information, of exposure information in each of the individual files, and combining them all together, and allows you to specify a specific tone curve that allows you to really allow specific pixels and specific regions of an image to shine through. But there are, even though Photoshop has some tools that allow you to do HDR images, you might find them to be relatively limiting. There are many third-party tools that have a lot more capability and a lot more power when we're actually talking about HDR. Now, sharpening is something else that I had remembered earlier on and do want to just talk a little bit about. Because of the way that digital sensors actually operate, and again, we'll talk about this even just next week, we'll allude a bit to it, they are by nature, digital cameras by nature, are not very sharp. They're not really pixel sharp. You might look at an image and it might look relatively sharp, but there are certain types of sensors that are ridiculously sharp compared to what we use in our everyday digital photography. And there is additionally some trickery that happens in the image processor of your camera that sharpens the image a little bit. The most powerful type of sharpening that you would probably want to do is an unsharp mask, which exists not only in Photoshop, but also in a variety of image processors as well. Now, there's a variety of sharpen tools, as you can see in the filter menu under sharpen. But really, the most powerful one in terms of photographs is the unsharp mask. And the reason for this is that, yes, it is, in fact, a mask of some kind, but really, we don't get to see what that actually looks like. But essentially, what the unsharp mask is it increases the local contrast of individual regions of an image. So here it's brought up in unsharp mask window, as we can see here. And there are a variety of options. Generally, the amounts or the values of each of these that you actually want to specify varies depending on your particular camera and lens combination. But I would say that having a relatively high amount of around 200% with a pretty small radius, something around 0.2 pixels or so, is a good place to start. You'll have to adjust this based on your own images, but this is a good place to start, and this will, in fact, increase the sharpness of your image. So let's see if I can. What I will do is undo this and zoom in to a region that is, let me zoom in to 100%. Really, the way that you're best going to see the results of your sharpening is by zooming in to a value of about 100%. And let's find some area here. So we'll just look at this region, which looks good. Open up the unsharp mask. Bless you. And let's see if we can focus on this area here. Let's change the amount to those default values, which have not worked at all in this case. Excellent. So the initial values didn't work very well for this particular image, but we can sort of see the results here in the before and after. So by changing the preview, we can see that, especially here, if you look at this region of the image, we see that there is this line of light that is perhaps a little bit fuzzy, and it becomes a lot more clear when I actually sharpen it. And essentially what the unsharp mask is doing is finding individual regions of contrast and just increasing the contrast locally, not within the entire scope of your image, but really just increasing the local contrast between some of these edges. And that it increases, at least to our eyes, it's tricking our visual system into thinking that there's more sharpness to the image than there might actually be. Just be careful with sharpening. It's possible to go overboard, and you can create some what are called sharpening halos, where you increase the contrast to such a degree that it looks like there is a white halo around dark objects. That's because it's increased the contrast so much that it's just gone too far, that it's just increased it to basically to be areas of white and black rather than just increasing the contrast to a useful amount. All right, so this has been sort of a whirlwind tour talking about perhaps $20 worth of Photoshop's $600 value. But hopefully this is a good place to start, particularly when you start editing all of the photos for your partner for Project 3, which, by the way, if you don't yet have a partner, then please do try to find one as quickly as possible. Do continue to take your sequence of 100 photos. If you haven't yet done that, hopefully you should have that done very, very soon so that you can actually pass it on to your partner and complete the contact sheet and all of the editing and all of that needs to be done by next week. And also, don't forget that there are three components of the project. There's actually capturing the photos, the 100 photos. Then there's actually editing somebody else's photos. But then there's the third, which is that survey, which really should only take you a couple of minutes, which will help us with the grading for that. And speaking of surveys, one of the things that I did want to ask all of you to do, though it is optional, is to actually go to a midterm survey that we have, which basically just lets us know what you think about how we're doing. You can provide a variety of answers to us, including what you think we could do better, if there's any topics that you want us to cover. As we get later in this semester, we start honing in on specific topics to work on, but perhaps you as a group want to go in a slightly different direction, and so that would be useful to know. So bit.ly/DME10-midterm, I believe, is what it is going to be. This should load the midterm survey. And again, this will be fully anonymous. You don't have to provide to us your name, your HUID, or anything like that. But we do just want to know, when you entered the course, what you specified as your level of expertise. So whatever you answered in the problem set one survey, just answer the same thing here, just so that we sort of know if there's any distinction between each of these levels, that perhaps for advanced people, we're not doing quite as well as we are for hobbyists or for people that are new or anything along these lines. This is information that we want to know. And there's really won't take you very long. If you do answer some of these questions down below, including what are we doing well, what are we doing better, please be very, very brief. We're probably going to get a wide variety of surveys, and we don't want to be inundated with essays. But if you have specific concerns, then do, of course, send email to the staff. But this is an anonymous way of just providing feedback to us. And with that, I want to thank you all very much again for coming. And next week, we will get to talk about digital cameras and specifically digital sensors and really start to finally put together all of the information that we've talked about in this class. So until then, have a good week.